Allow me to welcome everyone to the first State Affairs meeting, and this is January 21st, Thursday. Before I get started, I have a wonderful new staff committee person, Sarah Munson, and also is Sharon Benson. She's had a long history with DOT, and we're very fortunate to have her on staff as well. In front of us today, our agenda is going to be an overview from the Department of Corrections, and I so appreciate at the last minute they pulled this together. But this is exciting times, and of course, being representing both Wesel and Palmer, it is in my district, so I'm even more excited. But not to elevate that more than what needs to be said here today, please allow Joe, go ahead and if you'll begin and introduce Dwayne, please.
Okay, thank you, Senator. I'm Joe Schmidt, Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. With me is Dwayne Peoples, Deputy Commissioner. Mm-hmm. He's in charge of administration, budget, medical.
Okay, and I'll interrupt.
Sure.
Real quickly, to my right, I have Senator Hollis French, and I have Senators Kevin Myers, and then to my left is Senator Joe Passavant from Fairbanks area. Okay.
Great.
Sorry. Must not leave out my colleagues.
Greetings. Thank you, Senator. Just yesterday, we were in front of Senator French's committee, so I'll try to provide as much new material as I can, Senator, but some of it, I apologize, will be a repeat from yesterday, but... At one of the earlier places I was speaking, it wasn't in the Senate, but it was somewhere, graduation or something, and I opened my book for my notes, and my notes said fix dishwasher, and I realized then that Sandra had located my work folder and replaced, you know, therapeutic court transportability with something that was relevant to her, which was fix the... So I went home and I said, honey, please, you're killing me. I got to have my notes. So... It's just interesting to open. I have my notes, but I also have the Weight Watchers pocket guide. So with that, I will disheveledly go ahead with my...
Can I see that?
Please, yes.
No props, you know.
Okay, no props. I apologize. Thank you all for your time. And as I said yesterday, that's no more than just thanks for the time today. Corrections doesn't bring...
I'll interrupt again, and joining us is Senator Al Kukash.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
Good morning, Senator. Thank you. Yeah. Corrections doesn't bring great politics to the table. We don't have buildings full of people that contribute at the poll booth and at the church and at the business and all that sort of thing, and consequently, we don't have a great big constituency like Representative Stoltz said one day. And so those of you that get involved in our business and our issues, we appreciate that. I think it's for the right reasons. The folks that we talk to in these committees and afterwards and as we work on our issues together seem to care about what we're doing for the right reasons. There isn't a political gain with us usually, so we certainly appreciate your time. And what we want to do in response to that is always offer the best info quickly as we can. If we're not agreeing on something in a direction or something like that, it doesn't matter. We want to be sure to respond to what you need and give respect to the respect that you show our business. So you mentioned before it's an exciting time. We don't hear that very often. To us, it is very exciting. We're very excited about what we're doing, and we appreciate your interest. So thank you all. If it's okay, I'd like to just kind of go over a little bit how we got to where we are and probably talk a little bit about Goose Creek out in Point McKinsey, and then Dwayne has a numbers overview, maybe some of what our population is doing and what we expect it to do, and of course questions. I think with us is Leslie Houston is here, our budget director, and Carmen Gutierrez will be here as well if she's not yet already. So we started off the administration, and there was a 2,250-bed prison project slated for construction that had some momentum built behind it, and we wanted, of course, keep that project moving. Not that needing another prison is a big success story, because in our business it's not, but if the industry is going to create the jobs and we need the resource, let's have it here in Alaska, and that felt pretty good. But we found a great deal of resistance. The money, that there were some constraints on how much money we had to spend. It was a couple years, the bill was a couple years old by the time it was really starting to get going, and we just seemed to get resistance not only from the legislature but from community areas when we went out and talked. And once we started to talk about regionalization, getting some of the rural folks back home to the rural communities, and downsizing the main prison, it really seemed, with minor exceptions, it really seemed to start gaining steam. So what we learned, fortunately, early on in the administration is that's what the public needed from us, is more you know, they're arrested, they're locked up. That's important. That's the best way to, you know, immediately protect the public. But then what? And that's our job. Our job isn't to proclaim that we need more and more prisons. I think our job is to find ways to build less prisons over the long term. So anyway, that direction seemed to take. So we started down that path. We knew we wanted to do something with program and reform and changing behavior while we have their full attention. And we hired Brian Brandenburg, was a mental health clinician for 17 or 18 years out in the field. We brought him in to be the deputy director and be the architect of a program plan. And while he was doing that, he talked about evidence-based programs, you know, making change through programs that work. And we said, okay, not being program experts, great, go ahead. That sounds like things that work. Go ahead and do that. That's a good sounding way to go. Then there was a crime summit in 08, and we learned a little bit more about the public's reaction to what we're doing. Senator French brought Oates from a guy named Steve Oates from Washington up to present, and he started talking about evidence-based programs and the effect that they have and the positive effect they have on an economy and the prison system and everything. Well, now we had our own guy, our own ideas, and then we had this other person from out of state from a much bigger system talking about it, and it was really starting to gain steam, and it was kind of coming from the legislature. It wasn't my group of experts telling the public what they need. It was kind of the public telling us what we should do. Again, felt like the way to go. It was gaining a lot of steam. So we put that together. The numbers that were provided from Washington needed to be Alaskanized, if you will. So ICER was hired to take all the data from Washington and convert it to Alaska's economy, if you will. The wages up here, cost savings are different here than they are in a different state. So they were Alaskanized, and a list was put together. The Criminal Justice Work Group, of which I chair the Subcommittee for Prevention and Recidivism, looked at the list. And lo and behold, it went beyond corrections. Health and Social Service had some programs they were interested in. The court system, of course, their appeal courts were in there. And it really spread beyond our realm, which was great because we can all work together kind of in the same direction. So now we had our own folks telling us, we had a guy from out of state telling us, we had ICER, everybody was going this direction, and we were successful in getting a program plan funded. And it's implemented. Our substance abuse programs have been running since April. And we're very encouraged. We're tracking numbers, but I have to say there are numbers. And we don't expect to use our numbers to gain any more funding, of course. But we are very interested in keeping track. The numbers we'll use to expand our program someday will be from ICER or the Judicial Council or some outside entity that looks at these. But it takes 3 or 4 or 5 years to get those numbers. In the meantime, we need to know how we're doing. And the reason for that is some things aren't going to work like we thought. That's just the nature of working with human beings. And what we want to do is know that, report that, talk to you guys about it, whether it be in session at these committees or off session. And if there's something that didn't work, we want to be able to tell you that we know what it was, we know why it didn't work, and what we're going to do to fix it, and then hopefully retain what we're doing, and not just say, well, this program didn't work, let's get rid of it. That's the easy way. We want to always fight to try to do as much behavior change as we can. So the numbers are coming in. Brian's not with us this morning. He has some of them. But I wasn't interested in bringing them because, as I said, the program started in April. So the folks that went through the program, the three-month program, and then were released, really have only been out for about 6 months. And it's too soon to say, well, they haven't reoffended. Look how successful we are. We need to give them some time out there because nobody's going to buy that if we try to hurry it up. So anyways, just wanted to let you know that they're available. Anybody that's interested, by all means, we can come meet and bring them and present whatever you'd like, but that's what we're doing with our program plan so far. A couple of notable things here before Dwayne starts, if it's okay. The Hudson, Colorado move, we had all of our prisoners in Arizona, and the relationship was pretty good with CCA. Things were moving along. There were some issues. There was some, you know, there was a little bit of negotiating back and forth on some things we felt we should get from the contract and et cetera. But they were responsive. But there's places that are closing prisons because of the economy. And we thought that probably the value of a prison bed was changing out there when more and more open. And so it was just starting to happen a couple of years ago, and the contract came to an end. So Dwayne extended the contract for a year to buy us some time and put out a letter of interest. Sure enough, we even had states that were interested in bidding, which is, we didn't hear of that before. It's usually just the private prison folks. And so anyway, we had quite a bit of competition. Sure enough, the price dropped a couple bucks a day per prisoner.
Was it $6 a day per prisoner, something like that?
What, it's 58 now?
We're at 59. If we had continued at Red Rock, it would have been 60.
Yeah. Okay, $4 a day. And that's, you know, 1,000 prisoners. That's a substantial amount of money. It could have been even a little cheaper, but the CCA facility that was a little cheaper was in Minnesota, and the transportation was, we were having pretty serious issues getting there and back, and we have to move a lot of staff in and out to, you know, monitor the contract, et cetera. So what came out the best financially, and then there's more than just the financial aspect. What we're doing at, one thing we really liked about Hudson, Colorado, it's a brand new facility that only Alaskan prisoners are in. We don't share contracts, at least yet, with other states.
I didn't know that. That's good.
Yeah, Arizona had three, had Washington, Hawaii, I think there's even some California in with our guys, and that just tends to dilute what we, how we want our guys treated and the programs we want our guys exposed to. And so Hudson looks very much like Goose Creek is going to look, and therefore we're and it's brand new, so it's being built from zero just like we're doing with Goose Creek. So what we have the opportunity to do is build a program plan and an activity schedule, a daily schedule for the prisoners that's identical to what they're going to have at Goose Creek. So absent physical plant changes, they should be able to wake up one day in Colorado and the next day in Goose Creek and go right to program and be in the same place they left off and not have all that, you know, court order treatment stuff that we're providing that they're involved in. Just move them right in, and it should save us an awful lot of work working the bugs out of a new system. There's always going to be some bugs, and we'll be here talking about them, I'm sure, but in the meantime I think we can save ourselves an awful lot of that by just doing it once in Colorado and then transplanting the whole thing. The philosophy of Goose Creek, of course, was, it's, as you saw, it's very big. It's spread out. There's a lot of land out there, and we didn't
the square footage or the acreage that we have out there.
What is that? Close to 1,000, isn't it? It's about 1,000 by 1,500 feet. Yeah, a couple of buildings. What we modeled is a community within a community. It's a medium custody facility. After studying our population, we found we didn't need a great deal of close and max custody beds. We have Spring Creek, and if we move all the lightweight guys out of there, we'd have plenty of beds for our needs today for the heavier guys. So what we needed was a medium custody sentence facility with the capability of holding some bad guys periodically for overflow from pretrial, etc. And that's exactly what Goose Creek is going to give us. So very tight perimeter, very similar to a max facility. It won't have a tower, but it'll have a couple of fences, razor ribbon, fence alarms, arm posts on the perimeter, all that sort of thing. But inside that tight perimeter is a functioning community. And the prisoners will be expected to live as much as we can like they do in the community. Well, a great thing about humans is we adapt. The worst thing about humans is we adapt, right? And you put somebody in prison, and we don't want them to adapt to that. We want them to try to stay adapted to a regular life, mm-hmm. where you're expected to get out of bed and then make your bed and clean your floor, right? And then go to chow and then go to your job and go to your education, you know, and live just like we do out here, except in the confines of our micro-society. And those things seem to work the most efficiently and the most effectively for recidivism. So that's kind of the philosophy of that. Another piece that we're often proud of is a program in Bethel. And what we had was a halfway house up there. The facility has about 130 beds, and it's a small facility, and it wasn't filling the halfway house. So what happened is we were paying for 25 to 30 empty beds every day. And our first reaction, we didn't want to change the criteria by which we put prisoners out into the community. So we went to the contractor, Cornell, and said, we got to take these 30 beds out of the contract. We're probably not going to fill them. Unfortunately, our direction is get people re-entered. But it doesn't look like it's going to happen here, and it's really expensive. It's $100 a day or something for those beds. And we can't do business up here if you cut that much. That's a third of our contract. So is that negotiation? What is that? We went up there and looked. $8 milk, $7 gas. Probably this is real. What are we going to do with these beds? The state's paying for them. So what we did is we hired a sex offender program, a contractor to put a sex offender program in that half. Now, we don't let prisoners out of jail early for this program. It's not a furlough program. But what we found is after a prisoner serves all their time, we release them, and with the court order treatment, which at the time the state didn't provide in the correctional system, we do now, but it wasn't then, they were stuck in Anchorage where the treatment existed. And I won't say that they didn't belong in Anchorage, but all of the resource, all of the people that were willing to help them reenter were out in the rural community. So how do you get them home? Well, that was one way to get a group of those folks back to the, at least to the hub community, if not their village, at least back to the hub community where they're closer. We found the rural communities would welcome these folks back. I thought, I'll be honest, when I first went up there, that they broke the law, they damaged our small community, we can't afford them, you know. We didn't get that. What we got is they should be home where they belong. Well, that's just good for everybody, and we're paying for the beds anyway. So move this program in. I think we've got 19 people in there now. It's a 25-bed program, and it's been functioning very well. It has the support of the Women's Resource Center, which was right down the street when it opened. The community seemed to embrace the idea. We really didn't get any trouble, and we didn't come ask lawmakers from the area for, you know, permission or any kind of outspoken public support. It's a sex offender program. We know what that is. I mean, that's our job, mm-hmm. but we certainly went and asked, you know, if this won't work in your community, you'd know that. You know, help me, you know, convince you that it will work, or we'll take our show somewhere else. And we were pretty much granted access, if you will. Go ahead and try it. So, anyway, that's working out well. One example would be the prisoner who, we have a safety net, a group of folks that meet with the prisoners on a routine basis. And this particular person was functioning, had done his jail time. He was complying with all of his conditions, living in the program, programming just fine. Got a job at the gas station. That's great. And they knew from his past and from his file that he does A, then he does B, and then C is a sex offense. And they found out there was a young girl working at the somewhere close that he didn't tell us about. That's A, right? And he's walking to work, and he kind of diverts a little bit. He didn't do anything, but he was just kind of taking a little different path to work, and didn't. That's B. Mm-hmm. We violated him and put him back in jail. Okay, for whatever condition of treatment. A little while later, he of course gets back out. Probation puts him back out, and he's back in the program. He's doing fine. So he learned something about himself that day. Was that a failure? He went back to jail. Did he fail? I don't think that's a failure. I think that's a great success. That's what the program should be doing. Because once their jail time is done, they're out in the community. So we should. That's one, I think, good example of us being able to keep our eye on things in a detail level to stop that kind of behavior. So anyhow, that's kind of how we got to where we are and where we're going. Reentry, we're working very hard on reentry right now. One of our special assistants is working full-time on reentry programs, gathering data. There's a lot of groups in the communities that do different pieces of prisoner reentry. And we want to have a good list of who they are and where the money comes from and what they do. We don't want to start telling these folks what to do. Their money comes with different stipulations, but at least knowing what's all out there and formulating a task force that's recognized. With that, we would qualify for some federal grant money possibly. And, you know, we can talk about some of these community panels maybe for Anchorage. And it's still in development. I don't have any success yet to tell you about, but that's what we're doing. I think reentry will be our focus for a while. Without a good reentry plan, all the program in the world inside isn't going to matter, right? You can program someone with the best evidence-based programs in the world, but if they don't have a good reentry plan, they're likely to fail regardless. So anyway, that'll be our focus. Of course, our mission statement is secure confinement, reformative program, and supervised reentry. The confinement piece will be getting Goose Creek efficiently and safely up and running. Slated to open March of 2012, maybe a little sooner. As far as opening it, one thing that we have going for us on opening Goose Creek is that, you know, the cost, we're not going to save tons of money by bringing the prisoners home. Everybody knows that. And we've been honest about that from the beginning. Everybody knows that's kind of how that's going to go. But what that gives us now that we approached it that way, we didn't promise anybody great money savings. What that gives us today is I don't expect to have a crushing pressure to open it in a week, to fill it immediately and hurry. We can open a unit. We can run the chow hall. We can run the kitchen, the laundry. We can make sure everything works. You know, we don't want to take more than six, 8 months, but, you know, I don't think we'll have people saying, "Let you know, you're wasting a dollar every time you wait a second," you know, so I think that'll be and that should be the way that we approach that. I mean, human confinement is an important matter. A lot of people don't think about it or sometimes care about it, but we do, and you have to be careful, and you have to make sure all the systems work, because when the people can't get out and they have limited ability to complain, bad things can start to happen. You really got to watch it close, so I think we're prepared. We're ready to do that. We've got a good team in place. Our recruitment's working great. We've got our correctional officer count was 689 in 06. And last year, the average for the year was 774. And all funded, no over posts that don't really exist on the books, none of that stuff. It's all straight, good solid staffing plan. You know, that tells us that our recruitment plan is working good. And that was important, too. That's sort of like we're working hard on reentry right now to catch up with our program plan. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to open a facility. We've got to have a recruitment system that works. Nobody's going to believe we can successfully open it if we can't recruit people to fill what we had. So we're turning, the last one, I think we turned 114 people away when we opened for a position. So that doesn't mean we'll fill it in a week, but we are feeling very good about how our recruitment and training system's working right now. So I think we're up for it. I think we're ready to go. So.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I know. I would like my esteemed committee members here to have an opportunity, while it's fresh in their mind, with your overview before we turn it over to Duane. Would anyone like to have any questions of?
Madam Chair?
Yes, yes. Senator Myers.
I have a question. I think the reason why I took Goose Creek so long to finally get the green light to go forward was that, frankly, it's cheaper to send our prisoners outside. And I don't have a calculator here, but at $60 a day, what is that per year? I guess 60 times 3, 65.
Yeah.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, Duane Peoples for the record, Department of Corrections. The actual cost is going to be the actual cost for Red Rock in Arizona under CCA is probably, when you calculate the transportation costs, all the other associated costs, is probably going to hit around $75 to $76 a day. We moved to Colorado. I think the cost, and I have not done final calculations, when you consider all other associated costs, will hit right around $70 a day. So that would be the real operating cost. As far as Goose Creek, we are in the process of trying to do the final calculations on what that's going to be. I should have that in 2 weeks based on last engineering calculations for gas, electric, water, sewer. I'm expecting it to be about $35 million a year, someplace around there. Don't hold me to that number because I need some time to do the final calculations. So it probably still going to be cheaper to have them outside.
Right. But and I think where we came to was that when you consider family members being family. Close by, you consider that, you know, once they get out, then they're right here in Alaska. And you consider the jobs and the economic benefit to the whole state and community, that it's probably okay if it's a little bit higher to keep them here in Alaska versus sending them to Arizona or Colorado.
Yeah.
Certainly it does seem like our correction costs just keep going up every year, and I know that's an issue that you deal with in the Finance Committee. And I know, with the governor's speech last night and wanting to get tougher, and I think I know we all support.
This meeting will end in 2 minutes.
Oh.
I think we all support the governor on getting tougher and more longer sentences for sexual assault and domestic violence. But that's just going to add more cost to mm-hmm. to your budget. Now, I do see here in this handout, though, that you have a plan on trying to reduce the folks that repeat.
Yes.
And I think that'll help a lot because I don't know, I'm sure you guys know how many lifers, prisoners we have, people that just keep rotating in and out and basically spend their whole lives in the prison system.
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Senator Meyer, 5% don't get out. 95% get out in their lifetime. And I could find, but I don't have with me today, the amount that, you know, come back and how many times they come back. Two-thirds have been coming back with any kind of a program plan or reentry plan. And so that's the one we're trying to tackle. How many folks will the new initiative bring? You know, we don't know yet. And I didn't feel right going forward to these groups and saying, oh, we're going to need another prison, we're going to need... I don't know yet. It's going to take a while to get the VPSOs hired and get trained up. And then when they start arresting people, then we have to disseminate how many of those folks are a result of the initiative and how many would have maybe come in anyway. All that data has to be, plus how many folks, maybe we do something good with recidivism, and maybe that minimizes the impact a little bit. We need to know all that stuff before. But then when we do come forward, and we will one day, of course, we're increasing, unfortunately, it'll be with real numbers, real time. We can show you, we can prove it, and you fund it or you don't, but at least we have, you know, real time. It's not a projection or a guess or anything like that. So,
I don't think I have a question here, but but more of a comment. Just that I support what you're doing as far as trying to eliminate the repeat offenders, because especially sexual assault and domestic violence, those folks just seem to keep. They never get it. They never get that. You know, we're not going to accept this type of behavior. So,
yes, sir.
I think we all support what you're trying to do there. So,
thank you. Great. Thank you.
Senator French, did you have anything to comment? Or okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Duane?
Thank you, Madam Chair. General overview for the...
This meeting is now over. Thank you for coming.
But I thought, no, that's an impressive idea. This meeting back to order, September 21st, Thursday. And at the table, we have Commissioner of Corrections, Joe Schmidt, and Dwayne Peters is about to give us an overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Generally, the department's population, we manage two groups of population. One is the probation parole group. It's stable right around 6,000 at this point in time. The group that the commissioner was addressing with some of the programming elements is our incarcerated prison. These, right now, the population is about 5,650, comprised of almost 900 in out-of-state, about 3,800 in our in-state facilities, and the remaining balance are in electronic monitoring and in community residential centers. A year ago at this time, the population had unexpectedly, or unexplainedly, I should say, dropped down to about 5,250. And that stayed down partway through session last year. By April, it started climbing rapidly back up to where we thought it was supposed to be. I expect to hit 5,700 in the next month or so, which is where we think it's supposed to be anyway, according to our projections. This population, both sentenced and unsentenced in the institutions, will continue to grow at least for the next half a decade, if not for a decade. We anticipate 150 to 175 a year, fairly consistently. There's been some recent statutory changes that made misdemeanor assaults go into a third time into a felony, which will increase sentencing. It also increases the time for adjudication to be sentenced. There's been several other adjustments over the last 4 or 5 years to criminal statutes, which will cause that increase to continue. While we've addressed Goose Creek, 1,536 beds for the medium lightweight prisoners, I think that our impact and required expansion and growth will be in the unsentenced facilities, the jails. I think that Anchorage, Nome, Kotzebue, Bethel, and Fairbanks will continue to be heavily hit and will require additional expenditures in capital and operating in the next decade. These we will be discussing in our subcommittees, our finance subcommittees. I'm going to produce a report on our 10-year plan for construction and renovation and taking a look at our growth factors in those areas. So that's sort of a high overview of where we're going. I believe the chairman kind of wanted us to touch quick base on the Goose Creek facility, which was started construction about a year ago. We anticipate substantial completion by November of 2011. Now, substantial completion means we start taking it over, we put our equipment in, and we start gearing up to receive inmates in it. Right now, scheduled, we would probably start putting people in there in March of 12, maybe as early as January, February 12, phasing in through the last quarter of that fiscal year, and basically fully occupational during the first quarter of FY14, which would be in calendar year 12. Probably between March and June of 12, we'd be fully operational. I expect no great delays in the construction. We may miss by 3-6 weeks or something like that, but I don't think that's going to be a significant factor. As far as operational cost, we should have some reasonably good estimates within the next 2 to 3 weeks based upon final engineering calculations for gas, electricity, water, sewer. Staffing, I anticipate to have a total staff out there somewhere near 370. We will be doing our final postings also, or how the staff is going to be distributed on a 7-24-hour basis in the next couple weeks. Of that 370 or so. Most of them, 340, 330, will be new state employees. The remaining balance will be people existing and transferred in from other operational units, such as we have probation officers associated with our out-of-state population. We anticipate moving the vast majority of those out-of-state into that new facility. There are two handouts that were provided to the committee on the Goose Creek. Probably the one that's the easiest one to read is, and we'll give you the quickest summary, is Project Update December 2009 Project Status Report produced by Rise Alaska, who is our contractor managing the project for the Mat-Su Borough and the state of Alaska. In there, you will see on the third page in a quick breakout of the financing. Currently, with the last payment request into NESR, we're going to be spending someplace close to $67 million will have been spent obligated to date of the bond, which was $242 million. I anticipate no other great issues between now and next year. In addition to the bond, the state allocated $6.0 million state capital funds to supplement this to help put in the infrastructure of gas, electric, communications, and some road work, of which we've only spent 2.1 of that million. In the beginning, we were anticipating fairly steep cost in getting the utilities out there. As we got down to the final tweaking and negotiation, cost of $8 to $10 million for electric came in at $1 million. Gas came in at $750,000.
Yeah.
Huge savings because of working with the
cooperation.
Yes. Yeah. So that is it for the moment. We will have a couple analysis in accordance with legislative intent in the next couple weeks. One is looking at the cost of Goose Creek and the possibility of whether it could be privatized or not, and the other one is a statewide facility plan and where our construction, renovation, repair cost will be going and how we're going to manage the population in the future.
Would you, are you completed?
Go ahead.
Would you speak to feeding the prisoner? I think there's even something in statutes that said they must try to grow their, and we must put them to work, and of course out at Point McKenzie there's the farms. And just tell us a little bit about your plans for feeding the prisoners.
Sure. I start with what I did, and then Dwayne can go into much more of the detail on the contracting, et cetera, and the different companies and how that all that stuff works. But just recently, we had some meetings between DNR and some of the farm groups, farmers out in the valley, and our folks. Ms. Houston was there, and started to identify what the problem was. The problem was we weren't buying enough local product, and it turns out that there was some things that corrections should be doing. Now that within the last couple of weeks some product started to become available, so we put a memo out to all the facilities saying if it's within 7%, then we buy Alaskan, we buy local. And so we're going to do that and watch. Leslie Shop is watching to make sure that we are in fact buying when it's, you know, if there's a quality issue, they need to report it, and we need to investigate right away, rather than going halfway through the year and then finding out, well, the reason that we didn't in these cases was because of a quality issue. It's too late then to go back and fix it. So we're watching it in real time. And if there is no quality issue, then we are expected to buy the local product. And obviously if it's not available or the quantity we need, those kinds of things we have to deal with. But the expectation is that we buy if it's within 7%. Once we're watching that, we know we're doing that, then we'll see if there's still a problem. There might still be a problem, but then we have to go from there. I don't know what else we could do after that, but let's, you know, that might fix it.
Okay.
So that's kind of where...
You can tell I've had emails.
And oh, I bet you have.
And we're rich in agriculture in the valley.
Yep. I grew up as a farm kid. I understand. Yeah. And worked at the McKenzie Farm. I know some of the farmers. I completely support their plight. I really do. And as a big state agency that supports thousands of people, I think that we should be buying our local products. So anyways, we're watching it very closely, and we hope to have that rectified this year. So
and maybe just as a refresher for committee members, would you speak maybe region or communities, where are the prisons like Seward and in the state, just as a refresher for us?
Okay, there's 12 facilities, 13 probation field offices, and 15 community jails. So now I'm going to recite where they are. The facilities, obviously, Anchorage Complex, right on 3rd Avenue in Anchorage, and that's our primary booking facility. Matsu Pretrial, right by the courthouse in Palmer. Point McKenzie Prison Farm, next to the new site out there on Connect Road. Correctional Center out in Sutton. Highland Mountain Correctional Center, our female facilities in Eagle River. Yukon Custom Correctional Center in Bethel. Anvil Mountain in Nome. Fairbanks Correctional Center. Where am I at? Lemon Creek Correctional Center here in Juneau, Ketchikan Correctional Center. What have I missed?
Doing pretty good.
Seward, Spring Creek Correctional Center in Seward, Wildwood Correctional Center in Kenai. I think they got them all. Mostly from memory. That was pretty good. Sorry, Seward, I forgot you for a minute, but that's where I started, 1988. That was my first gig as a correctional officer. I should have known that one. But a couple of the facilities have been combined. Obviously, the Anchorage Complex started out as Cook Inlet Pretrial in 1983, and then in 02, the Anchorage Jail was built, and then they were merged in 02, I think it was merged into one. So it's a complex. Highland Mountain and Meadow Creek, one of them was male sex offenders years ago, and it was females. They were merged into one operational unit. Kenai has a pretrial and a sentence. So those three have been merged into complexes. But that's where we're spread.
The females are not merged into this new Goose Creek.
No, we have no spot there for the females right now. They're at Eagle River, and it's too early for us to talk about what the future holds. 10% of our prison population is female. 20% of our growth is female. So we're okay for a little while in our female population bed, but we're going to get to a point where we're going to need to expand one day, and we'll have to, you know, figure out where the best way. And like I said earlier, the best way to do that, we go out and talk to the community, the representatives from the community. There's a trail issue. We talked to Representative Hawker and some others about the community wanted a trail that was going to kind of get close to our prison fence, and rather than throw up a bunch of boundaries to protect our. We started to work out a land swap. It's still in process, but let's help them build their trail. The jail belongs to that community every bit as much as it belongs to us. You know, as long as we have to keep it safe. That's what we do. That's what we know how to do, and the community expects us to do that. But after that, we should be working with these communities. So Goose Creek was named by the community council. It was going to be Point McKenzie Correctional Center, but the community council unanimously voted to call it something that didn't identify their community by a prison. It's theirs. Go ahead. You know, we called it what the community wanted to call it. That's how it got its name. So,
Joe, what do you contribute the 20% increase of offenders?
Suddenly, I regret giving you that stat. I don't. That's a stat out of our offender profile. And I'd have to get back and find out what, if it's alcohol related, is it domestic violence, is it theft, is it drug? I don't know what the increase in charges has been. I just know that the number of females is increasing. It's still 10%. It's still a relatively low number, but it's increasing a little more than it should by its numbers. Yeah. Now in our system, in looking at that, I didn't look far enough to see what the crimes were, but I did look far enough to know the numbers are 10, 15, and 20. 10% of the prison population is female, 15% of the halfway house population is female, and 20% of our probation caseload is female. So it does, as you get lighter in the housing, the percentage of females tends to get bigger. For whatever that's worth, they tend to move through our classification system a little better. As far as moving through, when Mr. Peoples mentioned, as he looks for the numbers here, I'll just fill 30 seconds here while he's give the man some time. Thank you, Dwayne and Leslie, bail me out here. But when our counts dropped in 08, we 250. Our census went down, and that's unheard of. And as much as we wanted to jump out in front of the press and say, "Look what we did." We knew that when it goes up someday, we get to take credit for that too. And we're very careful not to, you know, because honestly, we didn't know. We did. Our program plan wasn't in yet. We were getting the funding for it, but we did not have it in place. We couldn't say it was recidivism yet. Hopefully someday we will be able to. We did some things with population management. We used halfway houses quite a bit more. We expanded electronic monitoring. We added it. We added electronic monitoring in Sitka, and we're working on it right now in Barrow, you know, and things like that. And I'd like to think the population that we had, a piece of that population, about 250, responded to that direction, that housing, whatever that was, that maybe caused them not to come back or just got them out of our hard jail beds. But what, an interesting piece of that, that year, we've been running 36% Alaska Native for year after year in our facilities. In 05, or in 08, the year that we dropped 250, the percentage of Alaska Natives went down to 34 and then went back up to 36 now that we started climbing again. So whatever that was, the Alaska Native population seemed to respond to that. And the only thing we had done at that point was the housing and the population management. Could it have been a demographic? Could it have been a population change? I don't know. It could have been a lot of things. I know when the state population fluctuates, so do we. So it's kind of hard for us to take credit for ups or downs completely because there's so many driving factors. A new police academy can drive our Anchorage counts because more people are out training on how to arrest people. So those kinds of things. Are you ready to save me or no? Okay.
Madam Chair, I had a question about maybe Mr. Peoples should finish this point. I have a question to go back on geographic distribution of our facilities.
Okay.
That can wait.
Ready for one? Thank you.
Madam Chair, this is based on last calendar year, December through December 31st, 08. 390 females were incarcerated on the sample period. Alcohol is 34 out of the 390, close to 10%. Drugs is another 60, so you would have 100, close to 100 out of the 400 are drugs and alcohol. Assault, 104. And
women are assaulting?
Just assault, whatever you want, across the board. We will supply you with the 08 offender profile, but that'll give you an idea. Shoplifting, property crime, 68. Public disorder, 40. It's spread out, but that chunk, those first two chunks I mentioned.
I appreciate the information. I don't know if others are interested in that. Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was curious, you were talking about the distribution of our facilities, and of course, Lemon Creek is just up the road from us here. But what about south of here in southeast? Sitka, Petersburg, Wrangell, Ketchikan, who keeps prisoners for us in those communities, and do they all migrate to Lemon Creek waiting for trial? What happens?
Sure. There's 15 community jails, and in several of the communities you mentioned, I hope Leslie has a list, so I can tell you each community that has one. I don't know if we brought that, but you don't? Can you recite 15?
Go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, those are generally short-term holding facilities, 10 beds, 20 beds, something like that, and they're while they're getting adjudicated, and then they do migrate. They come, in many cases, to Juneau from this region, and if there's any length of time. One of the reasons some of the communities like Sitka, Barrow, have embraced electronic monitoring, many times the judges might be dealing with a person who maybe could keep his job somehow, you know, doesn't feel like maybe jail is the right answer, but there's no other option. So it's nice to have that available. If the judges and the courts want to use it, then that's the way to keep them out of the community, or at least out of our system. If they go in and out of the community jail, you know, to EM, then that's better than transporting them to Juneau and back. So
then in the last 2 years, have you seen an increase on monitoring?
Yes. Yes. We're at about 250 statewide on electronic monitoring right now. Is that right?
And do they come up with new technology on this monitoring, and that's part of the reason why you have it?
Yes, I can
tell. New ankle bracelets, or
yes, ma'am. There's been some improvements in alcohol sniffing, monitoring on the bracelet, on GPS location. I'm going to get in the weeds pretty quick if I get into the details of how, but there has been some.
I won't ask any more of these.
Oh, thank you. No, but the technology isn't really what that causes some of the increase. We, as a philosophy, we wanted to use it when appropriate. Electronic monitoring, as we spoke of yesterday, Senator French, is it doesn't help recidivism. It's not proof. There's no studies that show it does anything good for recidivism, but it's very cheap.
Okay.
And so it we're picky about the offenders that we put on there. Mm-hmm. Our electronic monitoring program is running in the mid-90s as far as percent of success. The folks that fail electronic monitoring and come back to jail, I don't know of any new crimes. It's technical violations, and there's just a few. So, you know, and I'm comfortable with that because it's so I won't say there's a lack of restriction. There's monitoring and supervision, but it's not like being confined. And so we're very careful who we put out there. It has to be the right person. And I haven't pushed hard for more because then, of course, the failure rate will increase. And right now, we're just very comfortable with 95% no new crimes. Our, as we spoke of yesterday, our when looking at our population, where do these people come from? I talked to our director of probation and parole. How many people are putting back in jail? How many are violating? Technical violations, et cetera, from probation. 190 a month is the average. And my first thought was, that's too many. That sounds like an awful lot. But before we said that, we looked into who and why. And what we found is that 49% of the folks coming back from probation and parole have new crimes. Well, that means the judgment of the appeals has been very good. That's the right group. We should be. It sounds like we're putting the right number back. But we can't stop there. It's still a problem. That's still a lot of people coming back. Why is that? Well, we found that half of the ones that come back with new crimes, or a quarter of the ones that come back, committed their new crime after some contact with the court or the PO, like a summons, you have a hot UA, go see the judge, something like that would happen, and then they commit their new crime. I don't know why, but we're looking at why. Maybe they give up at that point. Maybe they think, well, I'm going back to jail, so they just go back to their old ways, and then they commit a crime, and somebody becomes victimized, and in away they go. And so to that end, Carmen's been working with the court system, various meetings with judges, et cetera, to try to find ways to quickly get them into court. We think maybe if there's a – we're not looking for more or less of a sanction. That's up to the court. But if we can quickly get them there, maybe address that issue, get it behind them, and then maybe then they will succeed. And maybe they won't. But we're going to try something. And I don't want to try to change the philosophy of who we put back in jail, because it sounds like they're doing real good just like they are. So.
As a courtesy, I want to, we kind of took a little segue there, and see if you had a follow-up, Senator French.
Sure.
Did he answer the question on the regional?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, for example, you've got someone in jail in Ketchikan. You know, they're awaiting trial. How long do you keep them in that community jail before you decide to move them to Lemon Creek? You know, what's the cost of that? You've got to have some guidelines. I'm just curious how you work out that. It's got to be a sort of a tough decision to make. But I can see that you've got to make it at some point.
Sure. Dwayne needs to take that one, if it's through the chair. I'm sorry, through the chair. Senator French, if Dwayne could take that one. Kodiak was recently having some issues with this. Part of our budget request is about $300,000 to keep Kodiak alive so that the jail doesn't close, we can continue to use it. But if it's okay to have Dwayne tackle that one.
Through the chair. Mm-hmm. Senator French, Ketchikan is a state facility. So when they're being adjudicated in Ketchikan, they just stay there.
They stay there. Okay.
Yeah. In Southeast, we have contracts with Wrangell, Petersburg, Sitka, and do we have something on Prince of Wales?
Craig.
And these contracts are between the Department of Corrections and the local community.
It's a city jail,
and depending on the facility and its beds, we have term limits on how long they can keep them, anywhere from 7 days to up to 30 days, depending upon the capacity of the facility. And so that determines how long they're going to be there. The cities always, unless it's somebody that's going to be in there under a 12-hour Title 47 hold or something else, will want to move them to where the courts are going to be serving them. So
ranks a misto, they stay there. If it's a felony, they're going to
come. They're going to come out, especially felony. If they're going to be a long time. If they're depends on how they class. In Kodiak, that's where the judicial seat is. It's got the courts.
Superior court.
Yes.
There, so you can.
So they kind of hang on to them there for as long as possible.
Sure.
So it depends on the committee, mm-hmm. Senator.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Kukesh has a question.
I was wondering if you had could tell me whether you filled all of your vacancies for probation officers, and I'd like a follow-up.
Oh, you know that one? Do we, what our numbers are on that?
Through the chair, Senator Kukesh, I believe we have 5 or 7 vacant POs at this point in time. I think we pulled the numbers the other day. Just a moment. Was it 7? There's 7 vacancies at this point in time.
And just to follow up,
yes, Senator Kukesh.
The highest population, of course, that we all know in per capita is Alaska Native. How many Alaska Native probation officers do you have? And I ask the question because I know there's no school for probation officers, but I know that there was a high qualification ranking in order to become a probation officer, and I'm just wondering if you are addressing that and what kind of direction are you going to in terms of an Alaska Native probation officer and where we are with that, if you have any at all.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Kukesh, we addressed not specifically probation officers, but overall state corrections employees, about 7%. Mm-hmm. I believe 16% of Alaska's population is Alaska Native, 36% of the prison. So I don't know which one of those should be our target, but I know we're below it at 7%. I don't know the breakdown of probation officers. We could certainly find out, and we could send that to you. When we talked about, we went to Fairbanks in the summertime, and we talked about that issue a little bit, and our training academy director came with us, and he's in charge of our recruitment. What he said the problem was the applicants. Not that the applicants are a problem, but the number of applicants, a reduced number. We didn't have the feeling that we were washing more Alaska Natives out than others. The percentages, in his mind, were about the same, but we needed more applicants to start with. So it became a question of recruiting, enticing folks to apply. That's the information we have to this point.
Could you address your, did you still require a college degree in order to be a probation officer?
We do. Or experience as a CO. You want to?
Through the chair to Senator Kukesh. The requirements and specifications for probation officers was recently revised, I believe, in the last 2 years, 18 months. And there was a greater allowance for substitutions for the education qualifications, including experience as a criminal justice tech, NISHN, which is part of our employees' classification. So there have been several people who have come in and worked their way up through the ranks.
So could you follow up then one more time?
Yes.
What are you doing about the 7%? Because we all agree that it's low. And whether or not it's in probation or the ranks of the employees at the jails, that's still low. And I really think that on probation officers, you know, recidivism is going to be a problem unless you have people that can connect to the people who are on probation. And when you have those kind of people on probation who are Alaska Native, but you don't have an Alaska Native probation officer, I think that's a failure. And we're not going to correct the recidivism rate in Alaska unless you start looking for people who have a connection.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Kukesh, I have to agree with you. What we've done, as Mr. People said, there's been we still require a degree, but that we opened up what you know in what the degree is to qualify. Our field office in Bethel has filled their positions by using criminal justice techs that started in the office. Alaska Native or not, I don't know, but I know that was an example of us using our new requirements to get the positions filled. Again, it's going to come back down to recruitment, and getting folks enticed to apply, and you know, a booth at the fair. I don't know yet.
Did you say a booth at the fair?
Yeah, we started our own booth, but again, you know, that's not targeted towards Alaska Native. That's just general applicants. Sure, sure. The Kenai College has a correction certification program now that was written by one of our probation officer there again. But your folks on the Alaska Native issue, none of these things do that. These are just overall getting more applicants. We're hopeful that the, you know, we can pick balance those numbers out a little bit with more applicants. But
just a suggestion then.
Sure.
The VPSO program. You've got all those people who have gotten into the VPSO program, and I'm hoping that you look at that in a serious way, because the VPSO right now can't retire on state benefits because they don't have that available to them. But they can on the probation officer program, and maybe that would be a step for VPSOs to look at, is to take the next step into the probation field and have their experience as a VPSO count in lieu of a college degree.
Okay.
I mean, that's a suggestion. I'm hoping that you look at suggestions from all over the Native community or the statewide community to do something about getting Alaska Natives into the probation or officer programs in the prisons.
Fair enough.
Just a suggestion.
I'd like to turn to Senator Pascvan. He has a question.
Commissioner, you know, I was listening to you in your early presentation today that talking about as a sentencing function the increases that you expect to continue over the next decade. And kind of the first part of the question is what are your thoughts on costs that the state legislature should be thinking about over that next decade? And then the more immediate follow-up to that is I know in speaking with the court system in Interior Alaska 4th Judicial District that through the 1st of December that they had a 20% increase in case filings, criminal case filings. And I was wondering if you were experiencing that or whether you were seeing that and whether there's an immediacy problem, something going on in the 4th Judicial District that has caused this 20% increase, and then secondarily on the sentencing function over the next decade. So.
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Senator Postlin, that's interesting that you bring that up. We were in Kenai recently, where the probation officers have about, you know, 67 on a caseload. Within the last few years, it was closer to 100. The DA changed. And so the philosophy of the court system, the philosophy of who gets charged and who doesn't, will definitely impact our work. What should the legislature be ready for, if you will, is what we're watching, of course, is there's always prison construction. You know, as we watch our growth, we always have to project out when we're going to need a new prison. And we're trying to, instead of needing three new prisons in the next 20 years, maybe just two. I mean, we're not trying to, you know, claim that we have the solution, but we're trying to curb the prison construction, but that's always the big one. That's always expensive. What we hope to do is come to you with a successful program and reintegration plan that's working, and we've, as Senator French said yesterday, bend that curve a little bit and you know, fund the program plan and expansions to that if it's working, if we can prove that it works. The reentry plan, any initiatives there, Carmen's working on, formalizing a task force, and then with that we would qualify for some federal grant type money. We'll be careful not to, you know, if and when that money can come, and that's with your approval. I believe we have to get approval to accept that money, but if and when all that happens, that we don't hire people that we have to lay off and the money runs out, and all those sorts of things that come with, you know, federal grant money. But community panels, maybe all these other ideas that we have cooking that we want to just come to you with, and what's working and what isn't, and hopefully the cheaper of the options. It's just expensive. I mean, there's no way around it. The most expensive is a secure confinement piece, and that's the most effective for protecting immediately, but it's the least effective for recidivism, you know, for changing behavior. So we have to do something within the facilities and afterwards. And so we hope to just continue to come to you with some successes as the numbers come in, and then that's what we ask for funding to keep. And then hopefully you will have confidence that we are watching and that our numbers are good and that we know what the projections are going to be, and it's accurate, truthful data, and then we go forward with an expensive system. And
yes, follow up, Senator Post.
Yeah, what I'm really wondering is whether you have, you know, my expectation is if you have a 20% increase in criminal filings, that by the time you have the charging documents, and then if you have a conviction or a change of plea, then you go to that sentencing structure where you get the sentencing recommendations. So from time of the filing until the time of actual sentencing can be a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
That may be a 20% immediate impact,
right,
on your system. And that's what I'm wondering. Whether,
I got you.
Whether that this is something that is unique to the 4th Judicial District. In part, my question is, you know, do you coordinate with the court system so that when they do, because they're telling me, Joe, hey, you know, we got a 20% increase in criminal filing. We have no idea what's going on. We're seeing it. It's surprising to us, but it may be 6-8 months or a year later before you see it. And so I'm just,
yes,
that coordination between the correctional system and
yes, sir.
I'm just commenting upon that because that's my information.
I understand the question through the chair, Senator Postman. When we look at something like that, a bail statute or something that's going to, anything that's, whether it be more filings or a change in the bail statutes or something that's going to lengthen the adjudication period, you know, it comes off at the other end, because when they're sentenced, that time counts. And so it isn't a complete wash. Obviously, it creates a population management situation for us, but not necessarily a big monetary situation, because every extra day you spend pretrial is one less day you're going to spend after you've been sentenced. So the overall time may not change because of that. It just changes where the person is. And pretrial beds are a little more expensive to run, but we don't react too harshly to that piece. That's how we look at that, and it's not unique to the 4th Judicial District. We see it in Kenai, we see it in Anchorage, and we have connected, I think, pretty well with the courts. As when I opened, you know, we were talking about where the ideas come from, and our team should, you know, implement what the public wants us to instead of telling the public what it is. And the third branch of government was also involved with this. We were invited to the judicial conference to speak and ask questions and things like that. We've been working, meeting with the judges pretty routinely about some of these reentry issues. And so I think we have pretty good communication, and no, not all the questions have been asked, and there's a lot of questions still out there, but we are connected pretty well with the other two branches of government, I think, and I think the communication is there. So Anyway, I hope I answered your question. Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner, I just want to thank you. I'm sure my esteemed committee members would agree. This was a perfectly wonderful presentation.
Awesome. Thank
Such
you.
Good information. I'll give one last opportunity to any committee member, but in the interest of, to be sensitive to time, because some have other meetings here, I sure appreciate you doing this at a short notice, too. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you.
We adjourn.
We are adjourned.